This is the podcast for June 22nd, 2012. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the Contempt of Congress Naked Twister game, it's the Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, everyone. How you
happy
doing?
Happy summer solstice.
Yeah.
We want to take a minute at the beginning of today's show to welcome the humongous amount of new listeners we have.
Yeah.
We're pretty astonished. And if you've been listening in the past 2 weeks, we would love to know how you found us, because we can't figure it out.
Where the hell you got this bad idea from?
Yeah. We expect that it's because people like Best of the Left and David Pakman and Sam Cedar were at either or both Netroots Nation and Take Back America conferences. We were not there. But when you subscribe to those podcasts on iTunes, we are recommended. And then if people go to those, they find that we have done 133 episodes without a break, and we're consistent, and check us out. And so if you're checking us out and you've checked us out this month for the first time, welcome. I'm Blue Gal, and you're Driftglass.
You want to give them a 2 minute on who Blue Gal is and where she comes from? Where do you hail from there, Blue Gal?
I hail from a cornfield in southern Illinois.
Yes, you do.
And so do you right now. Yeah, yeah. We are married, and we got married last August. We've been blogging. I've been blogging since Election Day 2004 as Blue Gal, and I also contribute to the blog Crooks and Liars. And I've done all kinds of things. I've done in 2008, I did a weekly video blog where I talk to people just on my camera and about politics. And now we're doing this podcast. And we've been doing this podcast since January of 2010. And I love doing it. So, and we haven't missed a week. We haven't missed a week since then. So we try to be consistent. We have wonderful listeners and keep in touch with them. They email us and send us wonderful letters, and we'll be talking about that a little later in the show. And Driftglass, what about you? What are you all about?
I've been blogging since 2005, and I blog almost every day, and I blog in a longer form than you're going to find in most places. Most of my stuff is original to me. I link to lots of people, but I do a lot of writing every day. I also do an awful lot of photoshopping, which is weird to me because I didn't Photoshop before I started blogging, and now I'm probably as well known for photoshoppery as I am for writing. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool liberal. I'm also a public policy wonk who knows way more than I should about labor market information, about sectoral trends, about manufacturing, about the middle class, about rebuilding the educational and economic infrastructure in cities. I know way too much about Chicago government for my own good. That's why I had to flee Chicago, Blue Gal. I had to, like Fast Eddie Felsen.
You had to get out.
In The Hustler, you know, George C. Scott, you owe me money. And I had to leave there. So about 20 years from now, you'll see me showing up in The Color of Money.
Yeah,
as
right.
An older policy expert with a younger, young gun, Tom Cruise-ish kind of guy.
There you
new
go.
Ideas about public policy. I've been in the private sector. I've been in the education sector. I've been serially unemployed for the last 3 years.
Yeah,
on and off. I write.
And your life has changed a lot in the past year.
It has. My life has changed radically.
You were a bachelor living alone with two cats in a big, huge condo in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're in a little teeny tiny house in the middle of a cornfield.
Middle of a cornfield with three stepkids who I adore.
Oh, and they adore you. And we had a fun Father's Day. Oh, my God.
We did.
We had their dad and you and three kids and me and ice cream cake. And it was just nonstop silliness. And it was a blended family around the table, and lots of hilarity ensued. So I'm glad we can do that for the kids, to everybody to be together. And and they're silly. And they're off with their dad. We're alone today.
We are.
And the first thing we did, the first morning the kids, should I tell them what we did the first morning at waking up with no kids?
Well, you're the sound editor, so if you overstep the bounds of propriety, you can just clip this right now.
We
All of this sounds really good at the very end of the process, because Blue Gal is also, in addition to many, many other talents, is the sound editor for us. So she trims out.
I prefer executive producer.
And she trims out about 3/5 of the rambling assholery I do every day.
Well, that's not true, but I do try to make us sound coherent. And we sat in bed and read for 90 minutes. I finished reading the Space Merchants.
Space Merchants.
And I would have never finished that book had it not been for having some kid-free time. So
it was an incredible sense of decadent luxury to have 90 minutes to do nothing.
But read a book. Yeah.
Paragraphs on paper held in your hand. And I told you that was a good book.
It's a very good book. It's an amazing book. And I highly recommend it to any podcast listener who wants to sort of go, oh, wow, they wrote this in the 50s. And they've updated some of the cultural references. There's a 2011 edition. That's what I read. And there are cultural references throughout this book. And they did update them a little bit. But, man, you read this book and you'll think – it's called The Space Merchants. Mm-hmm. And you'll think, wow, the intersection of politics and advertising and environmentalism and revolution.
What happens if advertising keeps going in the way it's going? What happens to politics if the advertising industry just takes over?
Yeah.
And what happens to the environment when you can convince people that a devastated and polluted planet is really wonderful? What happens to labor when slavery becomes just normal because you're addicted to the products the corporations sell you and you can't get off of them because it costs more to get off of coffee est?
Yeah.
Just keep drinking it.
Just keep drinking it. And I was thinking about that when I was reading this book. The number of people – what if you won the lottery? Mm-hmm. And you just took $100 bills and went through neighborhoods, and it doesn't have to be poor neighborhoods. I'm not talking about poor neighborhoods. I'm talking about just here. Here's $100, sir. Go out and eat. Here's $100. Go out and eat. Go out and eat tonight. Take yourself out to dinner tonight. How many people would choose fast food?
Yeah, because that's
what you eat. Going out to eat means you go eat fast food. That's even right. If you have $100, you give every person in your family $100. Go out and eat.
Because you've been trained.
Trained to do that. You've been trained to eat that crap.
And what our hero discovers in his long plunge from the pinnacle of society to its depths is he finds liberals.
liberals at the
bottom of society, desperately trying to save it from imploding. And what he discovers is that they're terrible writers.
Yes, terrible. And he has to fix their advertising. Their advertising's all wrong. Anyway, we're giving away too much of the book. People have to go read it. It's a quick read. If you don't have kids around, it's a quick read. And we do recommend it.
Well, this is my way of saying we're both writers.
We're both writers.
We come to podcasts
and artists.
It's a natural way of storytelling, but we're both writers.
We're writers and artists, and we're raising writers and artists in our home. Yeah. And it's a lovely, messy art house that we live in. Very little gets thrown away in our house before being examined as to whether it can be a project.
And a great deal of what we read and think about politics and culture and theology, what I think about the Bible when we talk about that, and we talk about that more than most podcasts, I think.
Well,
certainly more than most political podcasts.
Yeah, well, and part of that is my background. I have a master's in theological studies from a certain divinity school.
You have no idea how hot for you I am.
We don't mention the Harvard word very often in this house. Just in fact, it was funny. My 10-year-old went with her dad on a trip through New England, and she called me and she said, "Mom, I didn't know you went to Harvard." And I went, "Good."
Your secret shame is
the idea of just sort of carrying that on your shoulder all the time and making a big deal out of it is silly.
But by virtue of those things. Pretty much everything that we process, I won't speak for Bluegill entirely because that is, that's how the patriarchy works. But I will speak as a writer, an artist, and talking about my fellow writer and artist, my wife, is we process the political world, the cultural world, the theological world, whatever, as artists and writers. Mm-hmm. I look for the narrative. I look for the story.
I look
for, in every David Brooks column, and I'm not going to go into it, I promise, I look for that hinge in the story. I look for that razor in the apple.
Yeah.
Because every single one of his columns, there's a little razor. There's a little political partisan centrist razor hidden in there. And you can find them every time. And so I look at the stories I am told by politicians, the stories I'm told by my news media, and the stories I hear from the pulpit and places like that as stories. Not fiction or nonfiction, but as narrative constructions designed to make me think and feel a particular way or to convey a particular point of view or policy or persuade me in some fashion. And that's how I think we're a little bit different than other podcasts and blogs, in that we really do filter that through this ancient, the most ancient human activity, which is telling stories. And I'll tell you the thing that frightens me about the future, Bluegill, maybe this is where we can segue. Republicans are way better at telling stories.
Yes, they are. Liberals think their visuals are terrible, and their art, their sense of visuals, I think, is really bad.
They tell the same crazy, you know, boogeyman ghost stories to the same audiences over and over and over again. But they keep it very simple, very narrative, very emotional. And we keep tripping over the fact that we think we can beat them and persuade them and counter them.
With facts.
With graphs. Yeah. Here's another graph showing, oh, fuck you, I don't care about that. Yeah. There was a Pew poll, I think, yesterday or the day before that said something like 63% of Republicans still believe that Saddam Hussein had WMD.
And they're just
completely walled off. And that's walled off from the factual universe. And the only way – and so liberals are in one camp and they ain't going anywhere. And conservatives are in one camp. But that mushy group in the middle, my eternal question, because I want to win.
We want to win.
First thing you do in politics is you got to win. You actually have to hold office, and then you have to force the people that you elect to do what you want them to do. But what persuades people who are currently on the fence or floating around in space or whatever is not a fucking graph.
Yeah.
What persuaded them in 2004 is Dick Cheney saying, if you vote for liberals, your children will die in a horrible terrorist holocaust.
Yep.
That's a very powerful story. It's a very evil story, but it really, really worked.
Not to be fear-mongering to people just to get their votes.
Right.
But it's not hard to point to – I mean, there's a news blackout on the Ryan budget. Nobody talks about it.
Right.
But it interests me that yesterday, talking about the DREAM Act and Mitt Romney giving a speech at the DREAM Act and pretending like, oh, you know, Barack Obama's taking your vote for granted. And someone on the Rachel Maddow show said, no, Hispanic community has been paying very close attention to the DREAM Act and each vote and each step along the way and who – filibustered it and where the next step is and how they moved over to the administrative side to try to get some sort of relief from the president and finally did. And each step of the way, they've been paying attention. And seniors and people close to seniors and people who are about to go on Social Security and people who are looking for health insurance have been paying very close attention to the Ryan budget.
Absolutely.
And know what it says and know who voted for it. Mm-hmm. And I have to make a correction of something that I have said in several podcasts. It turns out that not every Republican in the House of Representatives voted in favor of the Ryan budget. There is one in West Virginia. David McKinley voted against the House Republican budget because he believed – he did not like the cuts to Medicare, and he did not like Barack Obama. He did not like Obamacare's cuts to Medicare, even though those are payments to hospitals and also reforms to Medicare Advantage. He said, no cuts to Medicare at all. I'm drawing a line in the sand. There shouldn't be any cuts ever to Medicare, which is, you know, you can take that as bloviating if you want to. But he voted no. So I want to correct that and say not every House Republican. There is one who didn't. But one of the things we want to talk about tonight, in addition to talking about Ryan budget and how things go, is this DREAM Act thing and the assumption that 60 votes is necessary to do anything. And why is 55 to 41? If somebody votes 55 votes for one thing and then no is 41, why do the no's win?
Right. Since the George Bush catastrophic tax cuts were passed 51 to 50.
51 to 50. And
with Dick Cheney casting the tie-breaking vote.
And people were freaked out yesterday. And I one on email, and then I also watched Al Sharpton. Freaked out about this farm bill, which cut food stamps. And a lot of more moderate, I would say, Democrats were saying, well, this cut really was over 10 years and isn't very much and isn't what the Republicans wanted. And it passed the Senate, and Al Franken voted for it. He voted in favor of this farm bill that cut food stamps over the course of the next 10 years. And this email thread that was on one member of the email thread was just extremely upset. Like, they're taking food out of the mouths of children, and Democrats are voting yes, and that just makes me furious. And I totally understand where that person's coming from. I have, in the past 3 years, been on food stamps. Mm-hmm. And I think it's safe for me to say this to our listeners.
Yeah.
Driftglass, your unemployment check when we got married put us over the food stamp cutoff. We lost food stamps because your unemployment check was too high. I mean, that's how things are. Yeah.
That's how thinly
thin the margin is. Yeah.
Let me just say, we are between us extraordinarily well equipped to cope with and understand the intricacies of social policy, social programs,
right,
government bureaucracies, et cetera.
Right. Writing letters when we need to. Yeah. Yeah.
You won't be tied to the person who doesn't have the knowledge or confidence to walk in with the paperwork in hand and know exactly who to sit down with and talk to.
Right. Have all of the birth certificates photocopied, have all the Social Security numbers in a row, have everything together in a folder ready to go
designed
to apply for aid. We know how to do that, you know, and we've had to.
And in that sense, it's designed like insurance is. It's designed with a lot of ways to make it easier for you to fail all along the way.
Yeah.
And so given that that's the reality of our social safety net, let's go back to the
So they were freaking out that Al Franken had voted yes. And, I don't want to criticize the people who were that upset, because there's a reason to be that upset. Other people, and I hate to say cooler heads, but that's sort of where I'm going with this. Other people were saying, you know, the alternative was no farm bill. The alternative was just nothing, no spending going out. And the argument that went back and forth was the person who was saying, well, taking food out of the mouths of children, was saying, well, why can't Democrats just stand up for their principles for once? The Tea Party can do it.
Yep.
And that's when I had to jump in and say, the Tea Party doesn't care if the whole motherfucker burns to the ground. They don't care. You're dealing with terrorists here.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't care if, okay, no farm bill, okay, no debt ceiling, okay, no, you know, anything but defense. We'll just hold it hostage.
Mm-hmm. Cut Medicare,
whatever. We're done. We'll just do it.
That's and too if much
you're
spending.
Gonna, yeah, and if you're gonna negotiate with that, and you live in Minnesota, which is a farm state, hello.
Good luck.
Yeah.
Good luck with that. And remember, these are people who couldn't spell the word deficit before Barack Obama became president.
Exactly.
Who didn't give a shit about deficits as George Bush was racking them up.
Yeah.
And once Republican conservative policies blew a hole in the floor of the economy.
Well, they don't want to hear about the Clinton surplus either.
Well,
yeah, that never happened.
Remember, the whole plan, and this is not exactly a big secret.
No.
The whole plan for racking up deficits during peacetime was so that you can absolutely limit. This is if you look it up, it's called the two Santa Claus theory of government. It's a real thing. It's a real thing. I forget who wrote it. Tom Hartman does a lot of writing on this. In the 70s, it was the problem that the Democrats are Santa Claus. They give you programs. They give you things. And how do we overcome that? You're never going to vote to take stuff away from people.
Yeah.
And this gentleman said, no, you vote to give them tax cuts. That's what you do. You become the second Santa Claus. You give them their money back. You give them tax cuts. And by doing that, you create a huge deficit that therefore makes it impossible to fund all the Democrats' social programs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you simply destroy them by creating so much debt, by salting the earth with debt and making it impossible for them to have anything other than debt reduction. That is exactly what Alan Greenspan told Bill Clinton his first day in office before he was inaugurated. Bill Clinton ran on exactly the same agenda as Barack Obama. Education, health reform, energy, ran on all those things. Those are perennials. He won. He was getting ready to take office. And the story goes, Alan Greenspan came to him and said, sorry, you're fucked. Your predecessor left you a deficit much, 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 much higher than anybody will admit, than anybody will say. And the markets will bail. The markets will crash the economy. You're screwed. You have to devote your first term to deficit reduction. Screw healthcare. There's nothing you can do about that. You cannot do any of the things you ran on because your Republican predecessors left a big burning bag of dog shit on your doorstep. And if you don't fix that, the markets will bolt, exactly the same rhetoric that gave Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And what did Clinton do? He sacrificed a whole bunch of Democratic programs. He sacrificed a whole bunch of constituencies. He did a whole bunch of welfare reform, yeah, kicking poor people to the streets. And that, you know why? That only worked because we were having a boom economy.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was willing to give those people lots and lots and lots of social services. I worked very closely with that effort at the municipal level. And I know what worked and what didn't. But the only way that Clinton was able to survive his first term was by capitulating to Republican demands that, yeah, we ran up a shitload of debt when we were in office, but you got to clean up our fucking mess or the markets will kill you and you'll mm-hmm. never get reelected. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lo and behold, he did it.
Well, and he had the Y2K boom in computer yeah. purchases and so forth.
Oh yeah, he there were lots of things that yeah. contributed to the Clinton, but the end, it is a fact that at the end of the Clinton era there was a surplus.
And we were looking forward to paying off the national debt in 10 years.
Yeah, the deficit yeah. was gone. We were trying to pay down the national debt. And George W. Bush ran on, well, that's your money.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
your money. We shouldn't have no surplus. That's your money. And that's why I know it's real. So all you conservatives out there who jack off to this nonsense that there wasn't really a surplus, that's all a liberal lie, go back and look at George W. Bush's speeches at the convention during the campaign saying that a surplus is a bad thing. Because that means government's taking too much of your money. So he decided to cut. And you know what? 8 years later, we're right back to having huge deficits that Republicans never give a shit about while they're in office. Because they're doing what they do best. They're paying off their oil buddies. They're paying off their defense contractor friends. They're invading countries mm-hmm. that they want to invade. They're funding their every neoconservative imperialist fantasy while the pig people stand up and applaud.
Well, and getting to the pig people right away, I want to get right into that, which is...
Yep.
We handed the Republican Party a huge gift toward completely mollifying the pig people with an African American president.
We did.
And it's really one of the things we do on this show, if you're a new listener, is we try to provide vocabulary mm-hmm. for people to talk with their friends and neighbors and fellow church members and people in bars when politics comes up. And you have to be cautious about outing yourself as a liberal, but you want to say something and not just nod when people spew crazy shit at you.
And the reason for that is very practical.
Yeah.
Which is most of the people who listen to Rush Limbaugh and watch Fox News have no fucking idea what a real liberal looks like or sounds like or acts like.
They have nothing but a very shallow crust of talking points. And if you just poke it with a needle, it deflates.
And then you say, I'm a liberal. Yeah. I send my kids to the same school as yours.
I go to church. I pay my taxes. I drive a car that needs gas, and I'm worried about gas prices. I'm the same as you in so many ways. Mm-hmm. And I'm a liberal.
Ground level to deflate.
Yeah.
Because every year, Republicans run against fantasies and phantasms yeah. and yeah. demons and boogeymen. And that's because their people stopped listening to what real liberals were saying about real things a long time ago. But as you were saying, let's get back
to... Well, and the point about racism in America, this is the defining issue. Racism is the defining issue. Mm-hmm. West Virginia's three top Democratic politicians are not... They're not going to the Democratic National Convention from West Virginia. They're just not going. And that's because of racism. It's not because of, oh, well, there's other issues about coal, and there's all kinds of reasons why people in West Virginia don't like Barack Obama. No. There's one reason people in West Virginia don't like Barack Obama. And I would love to hear from any West Virginia listeners out there who are boots on the ground about this, because I'm infuriated that this one state that should know better seems to be such a pimple on the national scene. It bothers me so much that they voted for a convict mm-hmm. over Barack Obama. Somebody sitting
asshole?
In prison.
Yes. Yeah,
racist pest hole. That's what I'm yeah. And I know we have listeners in West Virginia, and I know we have yeah. there are liberals in West Virginia, and I'd love to hear from you. It's the governor, Senator Joe Manchin, and Representative Nick Rahal aren't going. Mm-hmm. And they will not help formally nominate the president. And I think it's Joe Manchin who hasn't announced that he's going to vote for Obama. And these are Democrats. It's like, kick them out. Mm-hmm. Romney's going to win West Virginia anyway. You know, you'll elect, 40% of you will vote for a guy who's sitting in prison as a convict who's white over the president of the United States. That just, it's just wrong.
Well,
and those are Democrats, and that's what I mean by racism is the problem.
Well, and I'm sure you'll recall. I mean, racism is a true and clear problem, and
it's America's original sin.
It is. It absolutely is. It's the one that haunts us forever. Mm-hmm. In some way or another. You know, it's better now than it was 100 years ago. It'll be better 100 years from now. But it still controls a staggeringly large number of people in this country in the way they think, in the way they process information, in the way they react, and the way they lie to themselves about why they're freaking out. On the contrary to that argument, I remember Democratic Senator Zell Miller.
Yes.
Standing up at the 2004 Republican convention calling war hero John Kerry a traitor.
Mm-hmm.
A southern fucking cracker who should have been put away decades ago. But he was a Democrat, and they could haul him in front of the Republican convention and say, even this Democrat knows that John Kerry is a traitorous, cowardly American who will sell us out to the terrorists. And that narrative that even Democrats know that John Kerry is a pussy who can't be trusted is a powerful narrative. So, you know, that's what Lee Atwater said. Atwater's whole argument about N-word, you can't say N-word anymore, but you got to code what you're saying is not about policy. It's not about public policy at all. It's not about what's good for the country. It's not about deficits. It's about how do you encrypt your deeply racist message so that it will resonate with your deeply racist base in a way that doesn't attract untoward attention by people that you don't want to know what's really going on. So if Hillary Clinton had been elected president, the same people would be freaking out over the same thing, and I truly believe we would have had pretty much the same last 3 years, because that's just who these fuckers are. But add to the mix the fact that he's a black man from Chicago with a funny last name. They just lost their fucking minds.
Yeah.
And going back to the idea of storytelling, the reason why nobody asks why you need 60 votes all of a sudden is that our media, our David Gregory-controlled media, our mainstream media has decided 60 votes is now a trope.
Yes, right.
60
right.
votes is like a white hat on a cowboy. It's like, you know, a phaser in the hands of James Kirk. Nobody asks how it works. That's the six gun. That's the thing. That's part of the makeup of the story. That's the equipment you have. You need 60 votes to pass. Let's move on to the next question. Well, wait a minute. No, as you're going to say in the very near future, let's complete that sentence, shall we?
Yes, and that's the other vocabulary that I want to bring up, which is mm-hmm. whenever anybody says that, and particularly when they say that's how the game is played, if you want to trigger me into smacking you, well, you know, that's just how the game is played in Washington, smack. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be that way. The Senate is broken, and that's where we need to go with that next, is the Senate is broken. We've got to fix that, and if it means pushing to abolish the Senate, I've argued for that. As a very radical answer to a much more simple problem that they could fix themselves and seem unwilling to do so. I think there's a problem with the average age in the Senate, and I'm not being ageist here, but one of the reasons they don't filibuster is that most of the senators are over 65 years old. So they don't want to stay up all night talking on their feet. They don't want to inconvenience themselves because they feel like they are in such a bubble of privilege to actually filibuster something.
Matlock is on.
Yeah.
I go home and see my story.
Yeah, well.
And so they take the entire filibuster, which is supposed to be a dramatic action of standing alone. You know, Mr. Smith
goes to Washington. Yeah.
Standing alone, one lone voice, refusing to sit down, holding
Bernie Sanders did it at 68, age 68. He did it for 8 hours. It can be done.
But
they should still be standing up today, 3 years later, filibustering the Dream Act, and they didn't have to do that. All they had to do was say, oh, we filibuster. Sorry, yep. 55-41, that's not good enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, so that's broken.
Anonymous holds on bills.
Yeah, now that stopped. The anonymous hold thing, they did reform that in 2010. But the rest of it, it's just, oh, we're just going to filibuster, you know, a cloture, sorry, 60 votes, 55-41, not good enough, sorry, Dream Act. And then they have the audacity when Barack Obama takes what is really just a little conservative step in the direction of the Dream Act to say, well, he never consulted Congress about that. Mm-hmm. And the biggest lie of the week was John Boehner saying, no, he didn't consult Congress. He didn't go to Congress. We wanted to work with him on this. Mm-hmm. No, the Senate passed it 55-41. And because the Senate is broken, that's not enough to pass the Dream Act, even though it passed the House.
Yeah.
You know, and Nancy Pelosi knows how to get a bill passed in the House, and she did it.
If you're looking for a piece of litmus paper to stick on the forehead of anybody that you are trying to figure out, are they persuadable or unpersuadable? Mm-hmm. My favorite older one used to be Jeff Gannon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who was just it was a perfect story from the Bush administration, and go look it up. It's, you know, it's,
well,
it's the gay
prostitute who has a seat at the White House briefings with the press secretary.
To whom stories were leaked.
Yeah, and who asked really easy questions, puffball questions.
He was the softball. He was the way out. He was the guy you could go to for a softball question. How do you think you're going to be able to pass this bill considering Democrats are obstructionist assholes?
Yeah, yeah.
Great question, Jeff. Well, first of all, Jeff wasn't his name. He was an assumed name. So he was there under false pretenses. Secondly, he was a gay male hooker.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Secret Service let him in. Yeah. And the President of the United States.
Karl Rove stamped his press pass. Yeah.
They leaked him stories for 2 fucking years. This clown was in the newsroom. Now, again, as was mentioned at the time, probably by someone like Bill Maher, if that had happened to a Democratic president, don't you think something involving torches and pitchforks and mobs would have happened? But everybody just said, well, you know, this happens because we're not going to hold them to these standards. That used to be my litmus test. But my new one is the Sean Hannity cutting off Barack Obama's videotape.
Yep. And he cut off Lawrence O'Donnell's videotape, too. Turns out that's a regular habit with him.
In order to lie to his – Sean Hannity knows that the people who watch his show are inbred trailer-dwelling swine.
Right.
Who live and breed in Sister Fuck, Arkansas, and who have no concept of the outside world other than what comes rolling out of his sphincter and what they hear from Rush Limbaugh during the day. That's all these fuckers know.
Right. And so they never change the channel for news for to anyone else. Right.
They're
right.
Never going to bother to find out that this guy is just lies to their face, just pisses in their face all day long. And so you can't persuade those people because those people are no longer functionally human.
Well, I wanted to just add that Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post today repeated the lie, even though we all know, and it's been on Comedy Central, and Jon Stewart just eviscerated Hannity for this, and that's been repeated all over MSNBC yesterday. Charles Krauthammer can just come out and say, see, this is exactly, he just repeated verbatim the cutoff point, quoted the president up until the cutoff point that Hannity did, and said, see, he's got it. This is impeachable right here. That's just right.
And if you're wondering, Einstein was able to solve lots of physics problems by doing mental experiments without actually staring into the sun or being able to have a direct access to a black hole. He could sort of postulate what would happen if certain things occurred.
Yep.
So ask yourself, if you're trying to figure out if Jimmy over there or Susie over there is someone you can sort of maybe communicate with. Maybe they're a centrist. Maybe they're kind of squishy, cowardly centrist. And, you know, both sides are equally wrong. Ask yourself this question. If you sit them down over a beer or over a cup of tea or a glass of Pepsi, whatever you're drinking, and you say to them, here's this thing, and you just tell them what Sean Hannity did. Mm-hmm. Here is what Sean Hannity said, Barack Obama said, and then he got in a high dudgeon about how what a liar he is, what a hypocrite he is, and blah, 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 blah. The reason he could do that is because he snipped out of the tape the 2 minutes during which Barack Obama explained that, given all the caveats he had just laid out, he can still do certain things. And the things that he articulated that were within his executive power were exactly the things he did. Mm-hmm. So he was actually just fulfilling what he said he was going to do. Sean Hannity, like Andrew Breitbart, like James O'Keefe, like pretty much all of Fox News, simply doctored the videotape make it look like something it was not, the exact opposite of what it was, and then lied to his audience about it. Now, after a day or two or three or four, you think, you know, it's pretty clear what the case is.
Yeah.
Sean Hannity is a congenital liar. He is a sociopath, and he knows it.
Yep.
He knows he's lying to the people because, as Keith Olbermann once said, he said he and Sean were talking off camera, and they cracked up, and I said, it's just television. You know, Sean Hannity, it's just television. If these people think we don't like each other, it's just entertainment. It's just television. He's putting on an act for a lot of credulous, inbred morons. And he lies to them for a living. Charles Krauthammer lies for a living. And the question is, if you lay this very simple case out, it's very clear this is nothing subtle about it. There's no nuance to it. This fucker cut this tape off at a crucial point to mislead a bunch of people into believing something that just ain't true. And he knows it. And if the person you're talking to, if their immediate reaction is, well, the Democrats, well, some liberals, well, you know, Dan Rather, then you have...
You're not having a conversation. You're not having a conversation.
You can't have a conversation with them. Because if their immediate reaction is not... God, that's a really fucking awful thing to do.
Yeah.
Why do you think that happened?
Jeff Glass, are you banging your keyboard or?
I'm not, but I think my headphones. I'm so angry, my head is actually swelling.
I'm hearing some clicking going on.
I think that was my headphones.
Okay.
Because I'm wearing, you know, I'm dressed for the occasion.
Yes, you are. You were wearing a suit this morning, so that's very fancy.
I had to go early this morning to a. Chamber meeting, a citizens meeting.
With
the mayor to listen to them talk about municipal matters. And let me just tell you, to underscore what I've been saying, what Blue Gal and I always say, when you get right down to the job of paving the streets and making sure cops are available and putting out fires, everybody gets very practical when you get down to that level. It gets very, very clear about there's certain shit you have to pay for. And if you don't pay for it, the society falls apart. And it's nowhere is that more evident than at a municipal meeting.
Yeah, yeah. When it gets all politics is local. That's what Tip O'Neill said, and it really is true. I want to get back just briefly to this whole question of vocabulary and the fact that there are some people with whom you cannot have a conversation, and you've indicated really clearly how. To determine that, how to poke that balloon and see whether there's any give at all. I wanted to talk about this whole question of Bain Capital, which there's a front page article today, Friday, in the Washington Post about how Bain Capital actually specifically invested in companies whose specialty it was to move jobs overseas. Now, there's one that you might actually be able to find a little give on it. What did you say to me this morning?
Is the guy who laid off your dad.
Yeah.
Mitt Romney is the guy who laid your father off and stole his pension.
He's that guy.
And he made a lot of money.
And he doesn't care.
And our system permits people like that to operate, and that's fine.
Fine, and that's the point that I want to make. If you get up against somebody who said, well, you know, you can't punish success. You can't punish somebody for being a millionaire. Everybody can be a millionaire in America. This is a free country. And if you work hard, you can be a millionaire. That's great. I'm willing to concede that in a bar someplace and just have that argument. But the second half of that statement is always missing, and it's missing in our president's speeches. The only person really who's articulating this clearly is Biden, and maybe that's his job. But it really, the president needs to be told that he's got to start saying this, and that is, there's no problem with being in favor of wealth creation and people making it to the top, but don't expect austerity from anyone else if you're going to do that. The poor and the middle class in this country have had quite enough austerity since 2008. Yeah. And I want
a third or a quarter of our
wealth.
Lost every gain the middle class has made going back 15 years.
Yep. To 92 is gone. The austerity has already happened. Mm-hmm. So don't talk to me about Ryan Budge and how, well, you know, we need to tighten our belts and have an adult conversation about entitlements and this and that when you're allowing Mitt Romney to pay 14% in taxes and giving Ann Romney's a $77,000 business tax deduction for her dressage horse while the Senate votes to cut food stamps. You don't get to expect austerity from anyone if there is money to burn at the top. If Foster Freeze can spend $6 million and throw it and flush it down the toilet for Newt Gingrich for president, don't ask for austerity from anybody. There is no need for
Sheldon
that.
Adelson.
Oh, Sheldon Adelson. I'm sorry.
Foster Freeze was...
I'm getting my sugar daddies mixed up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's also time that we start calling the 1%, instead of calling them job creators and wealth producers and everything, we need to call them what they really are, which is hoarders. The banks are hoarding money. Millionaires are hoarding money, and they're hoarding money overseas. Mitt Romney has $3 million in the Caymans. Or Swiss bank account. Now I'm getting my Mitt Romney. I can't even keep my Mitt Romney tax haven straight, Driftglass. they're money hoarders, and they're hoarding the nation's wealth, and we're letting them because Congress is owned by these pimps, and it's got to change. And so if people want to talk about, well, you know, anybody can be successful, and I certainly wouldn't want my taxes to go up just because blah, blah, blah,
uh-huh.
That's fine. But if you make it and you make $1 million, don't expect everyone else to get their Social Security checks cut because you need a tax cut as a millionaire.
Yeah. And remember that Mexican drug lords are very wealthy. Just because you've acquired a huge amount of money does not mean you're a morally superior person.
Yep.
It means you have figured out a way.
And let's not forget, Driftglass, that Daryl Issa voted for Project Gunrunner.
Yeah, before he was against
I wonder if they're going to ask him that on the Sunday shows this week.
Yeah, I would think not.
Yeah, you want to have a...
I would guess not.
My money would be the second thing,
remember, the time that we're all, you know, that all of... All the conservatives I know, all the conservative white guys I know, are basically pining for the good old days. The good old days were like 1954.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. That the mid-50s were very, very good to them. And based on hard work, and there's undeniable hard work, but incredible good luck to be born when they were born, to survive World War II.
And to be the race they were and in the country they were. To be white and in America.
They were, whiter than they were in the country they were in, with abundant natural resources, with cheap labor, and with global competition effectively wiped off the planet by World War II. Virtually no manufacturing competition left on the face of the earth. The only place making shit for a really long time was the United States. And everybody had this pent-up demand. So guess what? We all got rich, and that's a fine thing. But that time that they want to hearken back to of the good old days was also a time of incredible government investment in infrastructure, mm-hmm. a time of incredible union activity. A third of all the jobs in this country or more were union jobs, and incredibly high marginal tax rates, 70 to 90% or 90% and up. Kennedy dropped them to the mid-70s. And that was operating on the assumption that once you have made it and made a shitload of money, we're going to force you to plow your money back into this country.
Yep, yep.
You've done well. God bless you. All three of your houses. Your kids are never going to want for anything. You're going to be able to pass along an incredibly profitable enterprise to them. But you made all that in this country. Thanks to the public education system, the college system, the infrastructure that we all paid for.
Yeah.
And here's the price of doing business in America. We're going to take a big chunk of your money above a certain level.
Right. You're going to understand that there's a maximum wage in this country and that we know you can live really, really well on $3 or $4 million a year.
And we're going to take a lot of that money unless you reinvest it in your company.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless you buy more equipment, train
more people. Hire more people.
You do all that. That's beautiful. But if you're not making
if you're hoarding it
capital, then we're going to take it away from you.
Yeah.
And we're going to use it to pay for schools and roads and Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and the things that we all need because we all live in this country. And that was the truth of the 50s and 60s. A lot of other things are going wrong then. racism was rampant in this country. The Klan was alive and well and public in this country. Lynchings were still going on in this country.
And women had no economic opportunity or freedom within marriage at all. Yeah, these were not golden years for anyone who wasn't a white male and straight. I mean, it gets to that. We've talked about that before.
If you want the economic golden age back, if you want that goose laying that golden egg again, look at what the factors were. And two of the factors were incredibly high union participation that drove up all wages. Mm-hmm. All prevailing wages went up because unions negotiated on behalf of everybody. And B, rich people were forced to spend their money in this country doing productive things with their capital, or the capital was taken away from them and was productively spent by the government building the infrastructure that made their wealth possible.
Well, and it's important to understand, too, that infrastructure building contributed to the economy growing. And that's the thing that we have decided to delude ourselves, that government's evil, government's wrong, government can't do anything. Whereas building roads isn't a real job, and teaching isn't a real job. But you know what is a real job, Drift Class? Apparently owning a private prison is a real job. And having a defense contracting firm where the only only money, the only revenue you get in your entire company is government revenue. That's all you get. Those are real jobs. And you own your own congressman or two or three or four senators too.
Yeah, you put them on display like your artwork.
Yeah,
and here's my congressman.
Circling right back to space merchants.
Yeah. I'm saving up for a senator.
Senator from Coca-Cola rises to the occasion.
Yeah,
and that's in that book. Go read Space Merchants. It's a very good book. We are getting near the end of our hour.
Yes, we are. We're
running out of time. I did want to remind everyone that Mitt Romney is taking a private plane from stop to stop on his bus tour and getting off the private plane and getting back on the bus to go meet with voters because, you know, you got to make that carbon footprint really big. Mitt Romney has the biggest carbon footprint of any candidate out there.
Oh, I think the President of the United States cuts a pretty big one with Air Force.
Oh, yeah. Well, and with his tanks that he rides around in. And I mean, I do get that. I get that the Secret Service likes the President to ride around in an armored vehicle that weighs 10,000 pounds. I get that. And he does have a very big footprint.
That everyone in the press corps knows that Mitt Romney is a complete transparent fraud.
Yeah. And they don't say it because
he puts on a costume, including a bus.
Yeah, that's the thing.
At very
that's
last
the thing.
Minute, so he can pretend to be.
Hey, let's eat a donut and be a folk. Hi, how you doing?
Hey,
yeah, I'm getting off the bus.
Hello, carbon base. Hello, useless carbon base. Actually, vote for me. Oh, I'm sorry. What sort of pastry is this? What sort of foods do you consume? Oh, really? Okay, vote for me. No, I'm just going to not touch anyone and wipe my hands over here. I have a little hand sanitizer I use when contacting you lower life forms. Thank you.
We have gotten some interesting information this week on our statistics, and we consider it very high that 60% of our listeners listen to the entire podcast, and the 40% of you that turn it off right when I start talking about where our podcast can be found. Why didn't you listen to the end this time? 61% of you listen to the whole thing, and that's really awesome. But we're gonna move on to our closing now, but there's some interesting information in there. So let me rush through this. You can listen to our podcast for free at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, at our Facebook page. I'm Frances Langum, L-A-N-G-U-M on Facebook, if you want to friend me. We're on iTunes and available through our fabulous app, available at the iTunes Store. We are on the amazing Stitcher Radio, and we are up this week. We have a little flame next to our podcast listing in the news and politics section of Stitcher Radio. We are moving up. We haven't gotten above Neil Cavuto's podcast yet, but we're working on it. So if you're listening to us on Stitcher, share that podcast via email or Facebook or Twitter. And that helps us move up in the rankings on Stitcher Radio, which we think is awesome. We are also on Netroots Radio from 6 to 7 Pacific and 9 to 10 Eastern at netrootsradio.blogspot.com. And we want to thank all of the listeners who have written to us at our email address and P.O. Box. Our email address is proleftpodcast@gmail.com. Our P.O. Box is P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791. That information is at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com. But we got an email from a listener of ours who has been giving, we have a button on our website that lets you give monthly. And he canceled his monthly donation of $5 and he increased it. And I wrote him, he's the first person that's ever done that. And I wrote him and said, thank you so much for your confidence in us. And he wrote back.
It's a horrible mistake.
No, we don't. We assume he got a better job or something. We're very happy for him and grateful to him for his confidence to increase his contribution. And he wrote back to me, and he said, it's not just confidence. You and Driftglass are doing something very important, and I want you to be able to keep doing it. And he gets it. If you like this podcast and you're listening to it in your car and you're going through a drive-through to get a cold drink and a shake, buy one for us. You know, or if you're going to the movies this weekend, buy us a movie ticket. We're not asking for a huge contribution, but think about the fact that people that you're listening to every week have bills to pay. And if you are a dedicated listener to this podcast and it means something to you, contribute something back. We would really appreciate it. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter in contribution again to our P.O. Box. Every week, we post at our website and Facebook page an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is Eomer, and I assume it's a takeoff on end of month, that this person must do something with accounting or something, E-O-M-E-R. Eomer's Human writes, professional left is likely the best political talk show anywhere on the Internet. You are the cathode of the battery that recharges my faith in humanity each week.
Aww.
That's the kind of listeners we have.
Yeah.
And we have a stack. I am sitting here at our dining room table with a stack of letters from you folks. And they're all so good, and we rarely have time to read them on the air. So we're going to do a letter show on July 13th. And I'm doing that because my birthday is July 16th. And so this is my little birthday present to myself, is we're going to do before the conventions start and everything sort of goes crazy, we're going to do, on July 13th, we're going to read your letters on the air. So if you have a letter to send us, you can send it, again, to our P.O. Box or our email address. Feel free to write us. And be aware that if you write us, we reserve the right to read your letter on the air unless you say otherwise. And feel free to say otherwise. So, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, the Internet Kitties are waiting patiently for Mitt Romney to make them tax deductible.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
This podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2012, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast. We didn't even talk about Ravolympics either. And that bothers me that we didn't talk about
You want to do a little post?
I want to be clear, starting to talk about Ravolympics, because everyone wants to know,
people what that
as
is.
A knitter, how I feel about this latest knitting controversy. There is a website called Ravelry, which is a social networking site for knitters, and it's a fantastic website. I'm a member. I love it. I live by it. They have 2 million members as of this year. And they do something every year called the Ravolympics, which is a knitting exercise and competition. They form teams, and you knit during the Olympics. You cast on you start a sweater or project at the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games, and you knit until the closing ceremony of the Olympic Games. And there, it's a competition to see who can finish the most beautiful project or the longest scarf, or there's all kinds of fun things that go on. But the focus is on this time period when you are ostensibly watching the Olympic Games and knitting. And the U.S. Olympic Committee sent their, what they called, their standard cease and desist letter to get Ravelry to stop using the letters Olympics at the end of their knitting competition exercise. And it turns out that they have sent this letter to other people. People were deeply insulted by this letter, but it turns out they insult everybody who tries to use Olympics or Olympics in anything.
Dear loser.
Well, they say, We believe using the name Ravolympics for a competition that involves an Afghan marathon, scarf hockey, and sweater triathlon, among others, tends to denigrate the true nature of the Olympic Games. In a sense, it is disrespectful to our country's finest athletes and fails to recognize or appreciate their hard work. And that apparently is in their boilerplate cease and desist letter to insult whoever's doing this.
I wasn't clear. Were they just talking? Were they only talking about dressage?
Yeah. The hard work of the dressage ponies.
Olympic events that are challenging to the athletes.
Well,
as well,
you know, and I realize that on the surface, this seems like a first world problem. That, you know, we'd be worrying about how the U.S. Olympic Committee treats knitters. But they sent another – people went batshit crazy over this. Like, how dare you? We are – knitting is important, et cetera. And also, more to the point, this is not like the Redneck Olympics or the Cutest Baby Diaper Olympics or the Book Olympics or – anything that doesn't have something to do with actually watching the Olympics. This is a watching party for your stupid show. Mm-hmm. And so to sort of denigrate people who are engaged in an activity that is to support your programming, it's to me, it reminded me very much of the whole Komen thing.
Yeah.
Of a corporation that is so out of touch with how actual human beings operate within the realm of supporting your activity, that you would go ahead and just cut off Planned Parenthood, or that you would say, "Oh, you guys, you can, you know, you knitters, you're not really, you know, Olympic athletes or anything, and you're denigrating what we do, so stop it." And people went batshit, and they went on Facebook, and they, in a very organized way, as knitters are wont to do, use the internet to express their outrage. And two apologies were issued, the first one of which said, you know, oh, no, we have lots of knitters among our ranks on the U.S. Olympic Committee, and we would be happy to celebrate your support of the Olympic team by taking hand-knitting items with us to London. Feel free to send them to us.
Send us craft.
So send us free scarves that you've knit so we can show you we don't hate you. Which, so that went over really well. And then and as I said on Facebook, you know, this got to be the opening credits of Monty Python and the Holy Grail of, you know, the person who sent the crappy apology has sent you another crappy apology and asked you to send them free stuff.
Has been sacked.
And has, a moose bit my sister once. And it's just, it's ham-handed. It's, corporate, it's just so, you know, and as people pointed out, come on, you guys are sponsored by Dow Chemical and you've got a problem with knitting. You know, this is not, this is ridiculous. And as I say, it's now gotten to the point where a lot of people are sort of submitting to this and saying, well, you know, we don't have to call it Ravolympics. It's what we do and we can do whatever we want and it'll still be fun. But we're not understanding that we're being bullied here by a corporation that is shooting themselves in the foot. And again, as I said, I left a long comment on Facebook saying, you know, has Procter & Gamble been consulted about how much you are insulting a demographic that is between 35 and 55 years old and has children at home? You know, this is scrubbing bubbles, people. Think about it. Yeah. Who buys scrubbing bubbles? Scrubbing bubbles and herbal essences. Who is buying that stuff? Is
perhaps,
there a crossover between perhaps
hygiene products as well? Perhaps we can get those elsewhere. I do recall vividly because I was through a strange series of coincidences up close, relatively close to the attempt to get the Olympics in Chicago.
Yeah.
Which transgressed a whole lot of ethical regulations. Yeah. They did a lot of things that were against city government.
City workers using city offices to, all over.
Well, and setting up a private, essentially using the chief of staff of the city of Chicago to set up a private company to manipulate the hundreds of millions of dollars and thousands of acres of land that were about to be unleashed in a semi-private entity that was going to
be... And a land grab within the city. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Some of the most prime real estate was set aside for this. I can understand why you do this, because you really do have to set up this kind of partnership. But in the end, the city of Chicago was gunning for the Olympics because the city of Chicago was going broke.
Yeah.
And they needed a massive...
This was going to save their bacon, and then it didn't. Yeah. And then Mayor Daley went, bye!
And then he sold a bunch of parking meters and got the hell out of town.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, the chief of staff set this thing up and then moved into the job that she had created for herself, which she might have very, very well been the best qualified person to do it, but that kind of thing is explicitly against the law.
Yeah, yeah.
It's against city ethics regulations that are well known to everybody who lives there. So the city was pretty clear that they didn't give a shit about the rules. They were going to get the fucking Olympics because of the cash. But the point I'm trying to make is the people who were involved in this, from the head of a major insurance company to the mayor to the chief of staff, were completely consumed by it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They traveled all over the world. They bid. They did, and every single fucking thing had to have an Olympic logo on it, an Olympic flame on it, because this was the cause that we were all going to get behind in the city. We're all going to push for it. And every citizen had goddamn well better polish their local doorknobs. So when the Olympic Committee comes here, everything looks good. And when you're running an enterprise like that and you already have a sense of entitlement and privilege and power and money, and really you just go anywhere in the world you want and you don't worry about the cost, you tend to forget that the rest of the 99.99% of humanity, but also the rest of your country, is just living their normal lives.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And trying to enjoy, you know, trying to not fall asleep during the biathlon.
Oh, exactly. And you're actually watching not only the ads for these shows, but all of the sponsors that are on the jerseys and in the background. And, yeah. And you know, this whole thing is just a big pimp mobile for corporations. It's, talk about advertising.
It's half corporate. It's the space merchants.
We keep going back to that.
They have cult.
Yeah.
These people who are deep inside the Olympic committee are cult members.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they probably have to be. This is what they live, breathe, and eat 24/7. Mm-hmm. And they completely believe in it. And they haven't slept in 6 weeks. And fuck you if you're not down. You get with us or we're going to destroy you is the approach that they have to take to survive in this corporate culture. Yeah. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that they just saw something with, you know, something.
Olympics.
And they just must destroy.
Yeah.
You are not with the program. You are not of the Borg. And then it bit them on the ass. And they suddenly woke up to the fact that there are 300 million of us out here who aren't obsessed every hour of every day with the Olympics like you are.
Yeah.
And are not entirely financially dependent on our privilege and our future gigs on satisfying the corporations that are sponsoring them.
Well, and as I say, you know, the point of this is, too, their blindness to the difference between somebody using Olympics and Olympic rings and valid trademark concerns, because if you give in on one trademark, then anybody else can say, well, you know, it's not really a trademark because you just cave on one specific instance. But if somebody wants to have an Olympics watching party, your sponsors are really interested in people doing that. And when it's an organization that has 2 million people as members,
yep,
doing that, having an Olympics, 2 million people having an Olympics watching party is pretty significant. And they those are women who already have internet access and the financial and intellectual resources to be on a knitting social networking website.
Uh-huh.
You are really fucking yourself when you do that.
Why would you piss these people
off? Why would you piss these customers off? Customers.
It's so easy to make them happy.
Yeah.
And just as a matter of historical note, somewhere in my packing cases, I have a little packet of taboo business cards. Because during the first pass at trying to get the Olympics, the city of Chicago printed up a jillion business cards for the little committee that they handed out to everybody. I got a fistful of them. And they violated the usage of the Olympic colors and logo.
Oh, gosh.
And the Olympic Committee came down on them like a ton of bricks. And said, you are absolutely not allowed. I think it was just the colors, but it might have been the colors and the rings.
Yeah, or something. Much. Yeah.
You are absolutely not allowed to touch, get anywhere near, or breathe this or emulate it in any form, especially if you're bidding on it, you dumbass.
Yeah.
And you know, the lawyers who were, you know, the city was always thick with lawyers,
yeah,
never bothered to check.
Yeah.
I do know they guard their copyrights.
Yeah.
And they guard their intellectual property.
Viciously. And like, I understand that. I do understand that. Because anybody could start selling Olympic rings t-shirts on the street and, you know, and you're losing revenue. But a watching party is revenue into your pocket.
Exactly. All of the Olympic ads I've seen for credit card companies are, hey, we all used our points to get a giant TV so we could watch the Olympics.
Well, and all these Procter & Gamble ads, the other big Olympic buy is Procter & Gamble being, you know, the sponsor of Olympic moms who put up with years and years of practice, and it's the hardest job in the world. And we love you, moms. Now buy our toilet cleaner. You know, I mean, that you're supposed to feel good about buying P&G products because we love you back. Turns out the USOC doesn't love middle-aged moms with knitting needles because they said Olympics. You know,
and this is why I'm not going to make a pitch for myself personally, but I'm going to say that inside of organizations, any kind of organization that grows to a sufficiently large size where everything has been automated and checklisted and is all done by the numbers. And all the efficiencies have been leaned out of the system, and everything runs perfectly as long as everything runs perfectly. Mm-hmm. You really, really got to have people in there who know where the fire extinguisher is. Once you set up the system, and I hate to analogize it, but you set it up like McDonald's. You have a keyboard with pictures on it.
Yep.
And punch burger, punch fries, punch shake, and I'm done. I don't even know math.
Yep.
All the calculations done for me. All I have to do is be this tiny cog in this machine. Unfortunately, when those things fail and break down, and William Sennett wrote a really wonderful book about this, about the Boston area bakers. But when the system breaks down, when something like Ravelry comes along that glitches the system, if there's no one around who knows how to take the initiative, who understands why we are doing what we're doing, what the overall purpose of the endeavor is, and has the discretion to make on-the-ground decisions, on-the-ground negotiations. You know, you should get a whole bunch of people who are specializing in negotiating with tribal warlords in Afghanistan and put them in charge of this sort of shit, because they understand you have to deal with certain constituent groups very carefully.
Or you just have to deal with watching parties that are actually watching the Olympics and supporting your programming differently than you treat somebody who's selling Olympic rings t-shirts on the street for their own profit.
Yeah, but that's
a different
somewhere in the hierarchy people. There was a 24-year-old marketing major who's handed a thing to do list, and anytime you see the word Olympics,
you've got to send the cease and desist letter and insult them.
Tell them to stop and make sure they understand the full weight of the Olympic Committee is behind them, and they will be crushed.
Yep.
Well, yeah, that makes sense 80% of the time, but you got to have somebody somewhere in the machine with some human discretion and understanding it, and if you don't, you end up with making incredibly stupid mistakes. This is why the Romney campaign is fucking up, I believe, it'd be fair to say. There's no one in the machine who knows what the hell this guy believes on a daily basis and therefore has no ability to act with flexibility and discretion on his behalf. So when a consultant spells America, Amercia, fuck it. That's a graphics problem. That's not my problem. It just goes all the way to market with nobody stopping it because it's a machine. It's not a human institution anymore. It's just a corporation acting as corporations do.
And that's that.
I bet.
And I want to do a shout out to all my Ravelry people.
Yeah. And I'd like to do a shout out to all the people that are married to Ravelry people who are impressed and amazed and befuddled and awestruck and
you know, we are soulmates. We have so much we're both Photoshoppers, we're both bloggers, we're both liberals, we're both this, but the knitting thing, he doesn't
quite get. Can't do it.
He can't make anything with two sticks and a string.
It's impossible. I've looked at the models, the statistical models and the blueprints. It's simply impossible. Like bumblebees can't fly. Bumblebees can't fly, and you cannot just make shit out of two sticks and a string. It can't be done.
And I did make you laugh yesterday because we were leaving the house, and I said, "Where's my knitting?" And you said, "That's a trick question. There's knitting all over this house. What are you saying?" All right, the end.
All right.
Thank you. Bye.